Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers and Religious Liberties Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, April 19, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the Trinity Lutheran case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our teleforum call today two guests, both return guests, both whom attended the oral argument this morning in Trinity Lutheran. We're going to start with opening remarks from Hannah C. Smith. She's a Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty right here in Washington, D.C., and she'll be followed by Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, also here in Washington, D.C. With that, Hannah Smith, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start with some background on the case, followed by my impressions from today's oral argument, and then I'll turn the time over to Ilya for his thoughts. This case is about the Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. The church runs a daycare and a preschool for about 90 children ages 2 through kindergarten. In 2012, Trinity Lutheran applied for a grant to resurface its playground. Missouri runs a program that provides grants for the installation of safe rubber playground surfaces using recycled shredded tires. The two purposes of the program are to reduce the amount of used tires in Missouri's landfills and also to improve the safety for children on playgrounds around the state. The program is funded by a fee on the sale of new tires, and grants are available to a wide range of groups, including public schools, parks, and nonprofit daycares. But not everyone gets funds. It's a competitive process, and applicants are given points for the amount of scrap tires generated in Missouri that would be used in the project, whether the playground is used by kids from low-income homes, and the school's recycling education curriculum, among other criteria. So the state ranked Trinity Lutheran 5th out of 44 applications that year and funded 14 projects. But the state denied the grant to Trinity Lutheran solely because it is a church. The state claimed that its constitution prevented it from giving money to a church. So Trinity Lutheran filed a lawsuit. It lost below. And as its last resort, Trinity Lutheran asked the U.S. Supreme Court to hear its case. The Trinity Lutheran case has taken a lot of twists and turns leading up to oral argument today at the court. As you recall, the court granted cert back in January of 2016, about a month before Justice Scalia's passing in February. Typically, the case would have been set for oral argument within several months, but Trinity Lutheran was not scheduled for oral argument for over a year. Meanwhile, the political sands shifted under the case in Missouri. In November of 2016, Missourians voted in a new governor and a new attorney general. That new attorney general was Republican Josh Hawley, who'd campaigned in favor of the church and against the outgoing Missouri administration's position in the case, and he had also filed an amicus brief on behalf of a private client in support of the church. So now in office, Josh recused himself from the case and referred it to his deputy, John Sauer. Finally, in February of this year, about 2 weeks after the nomination of Judge Gorsuch was announced, the court set argument in the case for today. But the twists kept coming. In a rare move, the new Missouri Attorney General's deputy asked Missouri's former Solicitor General, Jim Layton, from the previous Democratic administration to argue the case for Missouri before the Supreme Court. Jim had been on the brief submitted to the court, which defended the previous administration's position against the church. So the final twist came last week when the new Missouri governor announced on Facebook and by press release that he had instructed the Department of Natural Resources, which administers the scrap tire grant program, to permit religious organizations to apply for and be eligible to receive the grants. So the next day, the Supreme Court requested both parties submit letters to the court explaining how the announcement affects the case. And those letters were submitted yesterday, the day before oral argument. Both Trinity Lutheran and the Missouri Attorney General's Office submitted letters to the court agreeing that the case is not moot. In an unsolicited letter to the court, the ACLU, as a friend of the court, expressed its view that the case is moot. So first, the Church and Attorney General's position that the case is not moot. They both relied on a legal doctrine called voluntary cessation. In these sorts of circumstances, the court retains jurisdiction because the challenged conduct, though it has stopped, could recur as soon as the case is dismissed. And especially here, they said, there's a real possibility that Missouri's courts may enjoin future payments to Trinity Lutheran under the new policy if there's no judgment in this case from the Supreme Court. Immediately following the governor's announcement, the media had reported that a potential lawsuit challenging the governor's new policy could be forthcoming. While the ACLU said the case is moot because the church only asked for injunctive relief, namely the eligibility to compete for future grants, and that relief has now been given in the form of a policy change permitting the church to apply for and be eligible to receive a grant. Trinity Lutheran didn't ask for any damages or reimbursement, so there's no relief for the Supreme Court to give. So before we get to the oral argument from today, let's just take a look at three main issues that we at Beckett argued in our amicus brief before the court. First, the principle of government neutrality towards religion. Second, the Locke against Davy case, which was central to this case in the briefing. And third, Missouri's Blaine Amendment. So first, the Missouri Scrap Tire Grant Program's exclusion of churches violates the principle of government neutrality. This principle of government neutrality towards religion is supported by both the Free Exercise and the Establishment Clauses of the First Amendment. We said those provisions are complementary, and when they're read together, they support this proposition that one's religion ought not to affect one's legal rights or duties or benefits, as Justice O'Connor once said. The court recognized this neutrality principle almost 70 years ago in Everson, its very first decision applying the Establishment Clause to the states. The court explained that the government may not exclude the members of any faith because of their faith or lack of it from receiving the benefits of public welfare legislation. The court later applied this neutrality principle in the 1978 case McDaniel against Patey. There, the court ruled that the Free Exercise Clause prohibits government from excluding individuals from publicly available opportunities based on their religious status. In that case, striking down Tennessee's constitutional provision that disqualified ministers from serving in the state legislature, Chief Justice Berger explained the problem. To condition the availability of benefits upon McDaniel's status as a minister penalizes the free exercise of his constitutional liberties in violation of the First Amendment. Justices Brennan and Marshall also viewed the clergy disqualification provision as problematic, because it establishes a religious classification involvement in protected religious activity governing the eligibility for office. So McDaniel established this baseline rule that government may not use religion as the basis for classification for the imposition of duties, penalties, privileges, or benefits. The court reaffirmed McDaniel's ruling in the 1990 case of Employment Division against Smith, where it reiterated and cited McDaniel for the proposition that government may not impose special disabilities on the basis of religious views or religious status. And the court expanded on this rule in the 1993 case of Church of the Lukumi Babalui. There, the court unanimously struck down ordinances that violated the minimum requirement of neutrality, that a law not discriminate on its face, nor target religious conduct for distinctive treatment. So we see from Everson to McDaniel to Smith and finally to Lukumi that the court has consistently applied this baseline rule that the Free Exercise and Establishment Clauses forbid the government from denying public benefits based on religious classifications. But that's just what Missouri did in this case. It's excluded all churches from the scrap tire program, regardless of whether they meet all other secular neutral criteria. And that is just the sort of special disability on the basis of religious status that the First Amendment forbids. So second, the court's 2004 decision in Locke against Davy doesn't change this baseline neutrality rule. In Locke against Davy, you'll recall that the Supreme Court addressed the question whether the federal constitution requires a state to fund scholarships for devotional theology degrees because it also funds scholarships for other degrees. There, the court held that the federal constitution doesn't require states to do so because states have the authority to choose which degree programs to fund. But Locke doesn't change the outcome here for two important reasons. First, the denial of funds in Locke was not based on anyone's religious status. It was based on the state's decision not to fund a particular program of study. Here, Trinity Lutheran was banned from the scrap tire program solely because it is a religious institution. And second, Locke said that the denial of funds there was tied to a historic and a substantial anti-establishment interest, avoiding the use of public funds to support theological training of the clergy. But here, there's no legitimate concern that the funding would lead to anything like an establishment of religion. The scrap tire program reduces waste in landfills and makes playgrounds safer. Even under the court's most stringent no-aid decisions, like the 1975 decision in Meek against Pittenger, letting religious groups participate in the scrap tire program would be permissible because it would provide secular and non-ideological services unrelated to the primary religion-oriented function of the sectarian school. More importantly, under the court's current Establishment Clause jurisprudence, letting religious groups participate in the scrap tire program would be acceptable because, as the court wrote in Agostini against Felton, both religious and secular beneficiaries would be included on a non-discriminatory basis using neutral secular criteria that neither favor nor disfavor religion. So in short, shredded tires on playground surfaces protect children's bodies. They don't indoctrinate their minds. Now, finally, the state's exclusion of churches can't be justified by its Blaine Amendment. Unable to justify this exclusion of churches under the First Amendment, the state of Missouri resorts to state law, essentially arguing that our state's Blaine Amendment made us do it. Now, Blaine Amendments are state constitutional provisions enacted during a wave of anti-Catholic bigotry in the 1800s. They exist in over 30 state constitutions, and they prohibit the government from giving aid to any institution that is, quote-unquote, sectarian, which back then was code for Catholic. These old anti-Catholic provisions are often invoked to justify denying generally available state aid to any religious organization. But, of course, state constitutional provisions can't trump the federal constitution, and at least four current justices, Kennedy, Thomas, Ginsburg, and Breyer, have recognized the anti-Catholic roots of Blaine Amendments. Two of those justices, Thomas and Kennedy, have agreed that Blaine Amendments were born of bigotry and should be buried now. And four justices who only recently departed the court, Rehnquist, Stevens, Scalia, and Souter, joined them in condemning the anti-Catholic history of Blaine Amendments. So there's no real reason to assume that the Supreme Court will give deference to Missouri's Blaine Amendment. So just a few thoughts on oral argument. On the mootness issue, to me, it really seemed like Sotomayor was the one who was most concerned about this issue generally. And I think her concern mostly went towards the lack of adversariality, if you will, just her concern about the Missouri Attorney General's appointing Jim Layton to argue this case and whether or not there was really any adversariality between the parties in the case before the court. Justice Ginsburg said that it's technically not moot, but she kind of hinted that maybe this should be a dig because they wouldn't have granted it under these circumstances to begin with. Some of my favorite parts of oral argument on the merits, Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer seemed to be very concerned about the argument that Missouri was making. Justice Kagan referenced the longstanding constitutional principle that when you have a funding program, everyone is entitled to funding, whether or not they exercise a constitutional right. They're not disentitled to the funding because they're religious. She said this was a pretty strong principle and asked the Missouri lawyer, how is that not violated here? She also said that there's a clear burden on a constitutional right here because people of a certain status are being prevented from getting a benefit. Justice Breyer also seemed quite concerned with upholding Missouri's policy here, at least in this public safety benefits context. He seemed to feel that you can't deny benefits based on religious status. Justice Kennedy clearly stated his position that he thought this case was very different from Locke against Davey because here you had status-based discrimination. And he seemed to say through a couple of his questions that whereas here there's no Establishment Clause violation, there are no instances where religious status can be used as a basis for exclusion of religious groups. So I think I'll stop there with my observations on oral argument, and I'll turn the time over to Ilya to give his thoughts on the oral argument as well.
Well, great, Hannah. You took most but not all of my points, so I guess there's a bit left for me to cover. I should disclose that Cato filed a brief in this case, supporting the church, although it was so long ago, I had to refresh my recollection about exactly what we argued. This was part of the bizarre aspect of this case that Hannah touched on, that it was granted cert back in January of last year with Scalia still on the court, and then was not scheduled for argument. And this is an odd thing, until I think they set it for, argument today, I think they set it back in February or maybe even January, when it wasn't at all clear that someone, Gorsuch or otherwise, would be on the bench in time to hear the case. So they held it all that time, over a year, presumably because of concerns that it would be deadlocked 4-4. And then they schedule it without being sure that there was going to be a ninth justice. As it turned out, there was, based on what we've seen that's happened in our politics the last month and a half. And Gorsuch was there, although he was very quiet. I'll get to that until the very end of argument. And then the second surprising bit. So they held it this long, presuming that it would be deadlocked. There's really no other reason to hold it that long, I suppose, unless, I mean, you could, you know, start kind of speculating about whether Chief Justice Roberts, who's really the one that makes the decision about docketing cases that have been granted cert, unless he thought, well, maybe he'd have a chance for a broader opinion if there was someone else to agree with him. But then again, he's a minimalist, so he wouldn't necessarily be the one pushing for a broad opinion. I don't know exactly what was going on there in the dynamic. Plus, as Hannah, the upshot of Hannah's analysis is that this doesn't look like it's going to be a conventional 5-4 case, liberals versus conservatives with Kennedy in the middle or something like that. It looks like it's, if I had to bet, luckily I don't get paid based on how I predict the Supreme Court votes, I would have to say that it's going to be 7-2 with Breyer and Kagan joining the conservatives and Kennedy in voting for the church. So if that's the case, and meaning without Gorsuch it would be 6-2, then why did they hold it all this time anyway? Well, that's, you know, all speculation. We probably won't really find out about that. But running through the argument, Kennedy was the first one to ask a question, and so ears perked up right away, and he said it was kind of an unusual question. I had to kind of think back to what exactly he was getting at based on his further questioning later on. But he said, assuming that there's no Establishment Clause violation, and this was a point that would get repeated kind of throughout the argument, neither side was really arguing that it would be an Establishment Clause violation if even a colorable one, if the policy were reversed, then can religious status ever be used to deny government benefits or as kind of the operating principle behind a government action? Trinity Lutheran's lawyer didn't say never. He said, you know, you put me on the spot. There might be some cases, things like that. But essentially, Kennedy was getting at the idea that this status-based religious discrimination, as opposed to funding vocational training, say, like in Locke v. Davy, he was quite clearly seemed in his mind that this was a different case than Locke v. Davy. The status-based different treatment based on religion was simply not acceptable. And I think that set the tone for the remainder of the argument. As Hannah said, Justice Ginsburg seemed firmly in the state's camp, or the state's, I guess, former camp, as it were, raising Everson, the case about no tax money going for maintaining churches. But, of course, there's an exception for neutral public programs, and that's what led eventually to Breyer going on and on in somewhat amusing terms at times about not just police and fire department protection, but what about, you know, if we think about vaccinations or public health programs, these sorts of things that are justified legally and morally on the same basis as police and fire protection, as kind of community-based things. Well, what about safety of everyone? You know, do we want kids to, as he put it, fall down and cut their knees and get tetanus and then, I don't know, there was some other parade of horribles that he started going into as the room burst into some laughter. And he came back to that at the very end, that he was the very last questioner of the state's lawyer, James Lehman, when he talked about, well, what about grants for crossing guards or other children's health programs. The argument sort of ended abruptly after that. The Missouri's lawyer sat down even before his time was over, so it seemed like there really was nothing more to say. So let me fill in a little bit in between that beginning and end. As Hannah said, I thought the mootness part, or as Ginsburg turned it into maybe a possible dig, or Sotomayor eventually talked about adversariality, how this was just a manufactured case anymore because the governor's policy had changed, and the attorney general still appointed somebody to argue the old policy, even if the attorney general's office was itself had changed perspective. So I don't know whether Sotomayor would have preferred to appoint, for the court to have appointed an amicus to argue the position, or what. But anyway, that got very, very little play. By my count, a couple of questions by Sotomayor, maybe one question by Breyer, one question by Ginsburg. So all of this latest flurry of letter briefs in this week, after the governor's announced policy change last week, really doesn't look like it's going to amount to much. In part, perhaps, because there's been rumblings already that the ACLU or others might be challenging the governor's new policy, that is, of allowing religious institutions, including churches, to benefit from this particular program. So that's a very easy and obvious and clear demonstration that this is an issue that's capable of repetition but evading review, or that the state can't end a lawsuit just by voluntarily changing its policy for now, even reserving the right to change it back in the future, the so-called voluntary cessation doctrine. Let's see, what else can we talk about? Initially, I'd say Justice Kagan was less favorable towards the church. She was asking, well, what about if some part of prayer services were done on the playground, or how can we draw the line between funding religious activity and secular activity? Can't the state just take certain prophylactic measures to ensure that funds don't go to religious instruction? I imagine that also goes to the issue of whether of money being fungible, and so if the state doesn't provide money even for secular things, that'll save the church from having to spend that money on that it can redirect it to religious things. And at the end of Trinity Lutheran's argument, she asked, how does this take us out of the play in the joints? That is, if the church is denied here, isn't that evocative of the idea, the long-held idea that the court has had that there is some play between the free exercise clause and the establishment clause? It's not where one ends, the other begins. As a reasonable observer could see, for example, she concluded that perhaps if Trinity Lutheran keeps getting these grants and other larger Protestant churches, is the state favoring Protestants over Catholics? Someone could see. But by the end of the state's argument, as Hannah said, she seemed very concerned with the burdening of a constitutional right, depriving one set of actors of a government benefit because of their solely based on their religious belief. And so more likely than not, that indicates that she would be with the church. Justice Alito is probably most obviously showed his cards about being supportive of the church's position. At one point, he got into a little bit about the history of the Blaine Amendments. He seemed to indicate that the court probably doesn't need to get into arbitrating the academic dispute about the extent to which Blaine Amendments were sectarian or anti-Catholic or what have you, but did raise that issue, which is kind of lurking in the background. And he talked for a fair bit about the amicus brief that was filed by the United Orthodox Congregations, the Orthodox Jewish groups, talking about how, what about Homeland Security grants to harden the facilities, synagogues, and so forth against potential terrorist attacks, or the grants that were given to rebuild Oklahoma City buildings that had been damaged by the bombing 20 years ago. Some of those that were next to that federal building were churches. What about those kinds of grants? And the state's lawyer says that no, both of those would be improper uses of state money, at least under the Missouri Constitution. That got into some trouble, and that led Breyer again to start arguing about his police and fire and children's safety and all the race, all the rest of that. Roberts kept talking about the difference between devotional and secular study, as in Locke, that this was not, these funds were not going to fund anything religious, so we don't need to worry about the gray areas, those sorts of weird establishment clause questions about how maps are okay, books are not, what about atlases, that kind of perennial problem of a state entanglement with religion. Here it clearly goes just to the playground, which he actually got the state to confirm has never been used for a prayer group or, say, Sunday school on a beautiful day when you might want to have a class outside. You know, that's theoretically possible, but it hasn't. The playground has only been used for play. So anyway, the court seems to be coalescing around this idea that as long as you have neutral criteria that are being applied to a government program, then you shouldn't be able to. The government should not discriminate between religious and non-religious institutions. The idea that the state was trying to draw between this being not a general program, not a universal program like police and fire and all these things that everyone is part of, but it's selective, and indeed you have to apply. Not everybody gets selected, and as Hannah said, this issue arose because the Trinity Lutheran would have qualified based on the neutral criteria, but for the fact that it was disqualified for being a church. But that distinction between selective versus universal or general programs didn't seem to go anywhere with most of the justices, because again, even if it's not everybody gets it, everyone is eligible to apply, and that's really what the issue here. Here you're saying you're not even eligible to apply for this program. And it would have been a different issue had this program been simply for government schools or for nonprofit organizations. If you have a program only for schools, you don't have to include non-school organizations. If you include only nonprofits, you don't have to include for-profit organizations. The state has leeway in how to design its program, but it does have to have neutral principles to not discriminate based on religious status. So anyway, I think all of this is a bit of a surprise, especially, as I said, given how long it's taken to get from the cert grant to the argument. I meant to mention Gorsuch. He was silent until the very, very end of the government's presentation. I thought he was just sitting on his hands for whatever reason, because he felt, chastened because he was active in questioning the first day, and he read the news coverage and thought, well, maybe I should be my rookie justice role and not be active. But regardless, he did ask a couple of questions towards the end and mentioned that this is, to him, this is discrimination on the basis of religious status. So there you go. At my best count, if I have to place all of the justices into one side or another, I'll say 7-2, although there's certainly a possibility that, say, the more centrist justices, say Roberts, Kennedy, Breyer, and Kagan, maybe they could go together on some sort of plurality opinion with Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas, then having a broader one that's even more solicitous of religious liberty. That's certainly a possibility. But in any event, I would much rather be in the church's shoes here than in those of, I would say, the state, but as I said, the state isn't even defending its old policy either. I'll stop there, Dean.
Terrific. Well, thank you both very much. I want to go back to Hannah Smith and give her a chance to extend her remarks to the extent she wants, but first let me open the floor to questions and people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our guests, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We've got a lot of people on the phone. No questions just yet. That's the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to ask a question. Let me give Hannah Smith a minute or two to extend her remarks.
Sure. Well, I agree with everything that Ilya said. I thought it was very well presented. I could see another possibility, building on what Ilya suggested, maybe the possible outcomes for the vote count and the division of justices into different camps for the opinion. You know, I could also see an opinion joined by five of the justices, the Chief, Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch, that states a rather broad opinion, a la Mitchell against Helms, where there's a neutral program, you can't discriminate, and then perhaps a concurrence with Kagan and Breyer writing separately. Although I tend to think, having litigated the Hosanna Tabor case, where, after oral argument, we thought that there might be, a split decision, and then the court came out with a 9-0 win in our favor with the chief writing the opinion. I tend to think that they'll try to have an opinion that is broad enough to be able to include Kagan and Breyer with the five. My instinct is that the court here wants to have an opinion that has the validity of seven justices joining it. So I tend to think that that's going to be the route that they go, with perhaps Ginsburg and Sotomayor in the dissent, with Sotomayor perhaps raising some of the mootness or lack of adversariality issues that we've discussed as well. So that's kind of how I see the opinion perhaps breaking out based on the comments today.
Very good. If you'd like to ask a question and you're in the audience, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions pending. Let me start just by making a quick commercial announcement. Our next scheduled teleforum conference call will be Monday at 2 p.m. at this same number. That'll be on federal oversight of policing. Today, of course, we're talking about Trinity Lutheran. Let me ask a very quick question before we turn to the audience, and that is on the idea of mootness or a dig. Did the chief engage in that discussion at all? He seems to have institution
no.
concerns.
No, the answer is no, Dean.
Okay, very good. With that, let's turn to the first question of the day from the audience.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm actually curious, what were Justice Gorsuch's questions?
Let's go to the transcript so I can get the exact... I know that one was about how do you draw the line between so-called selective and non-selective or general, generally applicable programs, given that this one, anyone could indeed apply. How do you distinguish that? Let me see if I can, Hannah, if you have better memory right now as I kind of scroll through the transcript.
Yeah, he was trying to get at this line that, if you're talking about selective versus universal benefits, like how do we negotiate that line drawing? And I wasn't quite sure where he was going with that, but he was probing that issue. And then at the end, he had another question at the very end of the state of Missouri's presentation as well. Before Courtman got back up for rebuttal. So if you have the transcript there, Ilya, you might want
about, again, the selective versus general programs. How do we tell the difference? For example, those who show up at the Capitol for a tour who can afford to do so, it's not everybody, it's just those who, can go and afford. Is that a selective program? Is that a general one? Because, again, it's not everyone gets a Capitol tour. It's whoever goes out and gets it. What about copyright laws? You have to have an original work, et cetera. That was really the extent of it.
Now, did he seem particularly confrontational against,
No, he's very congenial and nice, and he didn't make any dad jokes like he did at his confirmation hearings, but he was very, nice.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. There's a second question, so let's take another call now.
Hi, I had a question, but it was just exactly the question that had been asked about Gorsuch's line of questioning. Thanks so much.
Thank you for dialing in. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. One question pending, then our lines are open. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Ilya. This is Elliot Hamilton of BC Law. I actually wanted to ask you, what do you think would be the overall outcome if it goes in the favor of the church? What do you think, what consequences or what benefits could come out of this hearing?
Well, I mean, it depends on what how exactly they write the opinion, but certainly if there's some any kind of government program for funding or subsidies that people are invited to apply for, then certainly religious institutions, states will have to open those out or make those available to religious institutions. You know, there's a question here about if states are required to do that, does that create some establishment clause concerns? But of course, if the Supreme Court makes a ruling of this regard, presumably that obviates an establishment clause challenge. You know, unless some funding program is geared specifically towards religious instruction or faith-based instruction, then you know, it's I think that's really what's at issue here.
Thank you very much, sir.
Hannah Smith, did you want to get in on that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on how they write the opinion, so it's hard to sort of answer that question. Just how broad the opinion would be would obviously impact various organizations differently. But, you know, I tend to think that, you know, they're going to write an opinion that is narrow enough to get, you know, Breyer and Kagan to join on, but broad enough to appeal to the five who are in the core majority. So, you know, I think what Ilya said is right. I think it's just going to depend on how they write the opinion. We'll have to wait and see. It's, luckily, we don't have to wait that long because it's only until June. So we'll know soon.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending now, so let's turn to the next caller.
Hello. There's a pending petition before the court from a case in Colorado involving vouchers. Was there any discussion today about school choice programs? And in that same vein, and Hannah may have suggested this earlier, as it relates to the breadth of this opinion, how do you see school choice issues coming into play?
Yeah, so you're correct. There are several cert petitions, actually, that are being held by the court pending the disposition of the Trinity Lutheran case. There are three cert petitions coming out of Colorado, and there's another cert petition that Beckett has filed coming out of New Mexico. I think people were generally surprised, actually, that the school voucher issue didn't come up in oral argument back in the Locke against Davey case. Questions relating to school vouchers did come up in oral argument and were a central theme in the argument and perhaps motivated some of the justices' decisions in Locke against Davey. So I think generally speaking with folks after the argument today, people were surprised that that was not part of the questioning that happened today in the argument. But as far as these cert petitions that are being held goes, you know, after the opinion is written, a clerk will be assigned to go back through and review the cert petitions in light of the opinion written in Trinity Lutheran, and then they will write up a memo that makes recommendations to the court as to how they should dispose of those cert petitions. And usually what happens is those cases are GVR'd, which means grant vacated and remanded back down to the lower courts in light of the opinion issued in Trinity Lutheran for the lower courts to reconsider their opinions in light of Trinity Lutheran. Now, if there are any cert petitions that are being held that merit being granted after a decision is rendered because it's not covered by the case that it was held for, then that is always also possible. And it could also be possible that the cert petitions would be just outright denied. So it just depends, again, on the scope of the opinion that's written by the court in Trinity Lutheran as to what happens in the disposition of those pending cert petitions that are being held.
Yeah, just to underline, I did a control F search on in the transcript, and there's no reference to vouchers, school choice, tax credits, anything like that. So we'll just have to see.
We've got three questions pending, so let's move right along to our next caller.
Hi, I wondered if anybody on the bench was concerned that some religions are better than others, and that what Missouri doesn't want to get into is having the animal sacrificers versus the human sacrificers versus the voodoo worshippers versus everybody else, Lutherans, Catholics, and so forth, competing for state resources so that they can build part of their physical structure and release other funds to animal sacrificing or voodoo worship or whatever else. I mean, the First Amendment doesn't limit what can be considered a religion. So what are the concerns there?
Well, an issue like this, the closest to that came up was when Justice Kagan remarked that why isn't it a legitimate state interest to say that we don't want to be perceived as favoring one religion over another? And even though the criteria of the application process for this scrap tire recycling subsidy are neutral, it does presumably, I think this is right, it's been a while since I read the actual application form, that if you are serving more children, that you're more eligible for it than if, you know, you have a little out-of-the-way playground that hardly anybody plays on. And there's certain other kinds of criteria that might favor larger, more established churches or religious houses of worship than other kinds, and so the state could be seen as favoring, you know, large institutions or old institutions versus new ones or what have you. But at the end of the day, given that the criteria are all public record and it's not some secretive process, even if an observer could see the, you know, it would further be harder for the observer to know which particular playground, I suppose, is being subsidized versus not. So if an observer is good enough to find out which playgrounds or of which religious community is being subsidized, then I suppose that observer would also be able to see that the contest was done based on certain neutral criteria, not to favor one religion over another.
Hannah Smith, anything on this?
No, that's right. I mean, in response to Justice Kagan's question on that, you know, David Kortman just said, look, this is religion blind. This program is based on secular neutral criteria. And so I think what Ilya said is exactly right.
Good. We still have three questions pending, as if by magic. So let's continue to work through our audience questions.
Hi, Taylor Smith here from South Carolina. I have two questions. The first is, can you give me one or two examples of an application of a Blaine Amendment that would be constitutional? And my second question is, if you were advising some state representatives on how to fashion something like a Blaine Amendment that would be fair and yet achieve a state policy of not supporting religious institutions, what would you advise them?
It's pretty hard for me to envision what you're discussing because, you know, we at Beckett are litigating many cases around the country where Blaine Amendments are just wreaking havoc against religious organizations of all stripes. I mean, for example, we just had a case in Florida where we represented Prisoners of Christ. It's a prison ministry program that helps ex-convicts after they come out of jail to help them get back on their feet and gives them job training, counseling, and food and clothing and all sorts of wonderful services. And, you know, an activist group down there in Florida came in and said, you know, we don't like it that you're partnering with federal money or with state money to run this program. And so we're going to, you know, bring a lawsuit using the Florida Blaine Amendment and try and stop this. Well, luckily, you know, we stepped in and we litigated the case and we said, look, there's this ugly anti-Catholic bigotry behind these Blaine Amendments. And at the end of the day, the court agreed with our position and said that the Prisoners for Christ could continue to help these prisoners using state funds, that that was not a problem. There's another case in Oklahoma that we participated in, which was even more dramatic in some ways, where Oklahoma had set up a scholarship program for learning disabled kids to be able to use money to go to a private school that met their specific learning differences and their different profiles for educational purposes. And, you know, the scholarship program set up these scholarships so that these students could receive these funds. Well, there were like four school districts out of something like 540 that said, well, we can't do that. We can't give these funds to these students because that would violate our Oklahoma Blaine Amendment. And so they actually litigated this case in for 5 years. And at one point, the school districts even sued their own students. The school district sued the parents of learning disabled children for accepting these scholarships. And we litigated this case. And at the end of the day, the Oklahoma Supreme Court agreed with us and said, look, you know, these state Blaine amendments, you know, can't prevent the use of these state funds for these learning disabled kids in the scholarship program. So these are just two examples of cases where we've seen across the country these Blaine amendments be used in really pernicious ways to prevent legitimate religious organizations doing a lot of good for people around the country. And so it's hard for me to imagine the kind of scenario that you're discussing here, because we're so in the trenches with litigating these cases where they do so much damage to good religious organizations that are trying to help their communities.
Yeah, I'll just add that, as you picked up from Hannah's discussion, most of the issues with Blaine Amendments are in the education realm. That came up in an earlier question, of course. That's what's one of the largest policy backdrops here. It's not recycled tire programs or other, you know, asbestos remediation or fire extinguisher provision, as came up in one of the hypotheticals during the argument today. It mostly is in the voucher, tax credit, or other school choice program area. And look, apart from those examples, which I, for the reasons Hannah talked about, I think are pernicious, you know, you have the federal establishment clause in the Constitution. I'm not sure that there is something that the U.S. Constitution's establishment clause allows that a state could prohibit as being unduly entangling with religion. You know, you don't have to have a government program necessarily to fund private schools to have school choice, I suppose. But if you have those kind of flexible scholarship programs or tax credits or scrap tire recycling programs, if you do have them, then I can't imagine how you know, you could draw up a program that wouldn't be afoul of free exercise or equal protection or some other way, because short of a program, and I mentioned this in my opening remarks, short of a program that specifically is a state giving funds to promote the training of priests or something, because we don't have enough, or just religious ministers of all kinds. We don't discriminate among religions, but we're just going to promote vocational training of religious leaders of whatever kind, of whatever religion you want, because we think it's a public health problem that not enough people have faith, or whatever the justification might be. That, I think, would violate a Blaine Amendment, but it's such an obvious Establishment Clause violation as well. I just don't see it.
Well, thank you so much.
We've got about 10 minutes. One question pending. We might have time for another question. If you'd like to be that final question, press the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's head in a new direction now. Go ahead.
My question might dovetail a little bit with the last question. I'm trying to clarify the scope of the likely decision you see coming down from the court. they would just rule that a particular action of the state here denying the permit for the tires or whatever to the church violated the First Amendment. But what would it take to invalidate, you know, the Blaine Amendment in this constitution and by implication in all the states around the country?
So I think in this particular case, ADF did not include a broad facial challenge to the Blaine Amendment in this case. It was an as-applied challenge here. And so if I remember correctly, I believe one of the pending Colorado cert petitions actually does have a much broader facial challenge to the Blaine Amendments. So, you know, depending on what happens with those petitions and how the opinion is written in this case, you perhaps could see one of those Colorado cert petitions granted if they wanted to address that broader question of the constitutionality of those Blaine Amendments, which would potentially have more far-reaching consequences for the survival of those Blaine Amendments around the country. But as far as this case goes, I think ADF strategically chose to take a more narrow approach.
Yeah, there are different kinds of Blaine Amendments around the country. Some of them just prohibit direct aid to houses of worship. Some prohibit direct aid to any sort of religious institution, including, I suppose, schools or social service centers that are affiliated with a particular religious institution. Some of them go broader and just say any direct or indirect aid to religious establishments. But nevertheless, no state has tried to deny police and fire protection, even though if you read, you know, indirect aid, well, you know, anything is indirect aid. So I think a lot of these cases that come up, in effect, and even this one might be able to be read that way, to cabin Blaine Amendments to things that, you know, as I said, that the Establishment Clause already covers.
We do have time for a final question. Let me make a call for a final question. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to have the final question of the day. Let me ask a quick factual question while we see if somebody weighs in here. You know, the school that my kids went to had a playground, of course, and it was, generally speaking, open to the public during non-school hours. Is there anything in the record on whether that's the case here?
Yes, it was the case here. The Trinity Lutheran Church preschool playground was open after hours on weekdays and on the weekends to the neighborhood kids, and was used by the neighborhood kids for that purpose. So it was open to everyone in the surrounding neighborhood.
So everybody could be safe. But did that factor into the briefs and the argument at all, or was that just sort of an interesting fact off to the side?
We highlighted that in our amicus brief before the court, that it wasn't just the kids at the church preschool that would benefit from this, but it was all the kids in the neighborhood that would benefit from this safety program.
Right. Okay, we do have two questions now. So let's see, now we've gone from having too much time to have a bit of a challenge to get through these final two questions. Go ahead, caller.
So I'm wondering if any of the conservative judges latched on to Breyer's line of questioning and kind of followed in the same vein, or if Breyer was a bit on his own there.
Well, nobody exactly asks questions the way Breyer does, for good or ill. I guess Alito's line using the amicus brief by the Orthodox congregations about I guess this was federal funding, DHS grants for hardening targets and things like that. That sort of went towards that sort of argument, but there were no further considerations of public health or kids' skin, knees, and all the rest of it. And by the way, I should add, when I first heard about this case, I sort of chuckled because it seems to me like this, you know, turning kids into snowflakes and what have you. You know, when I was growing up, I'm not that old, for heaven's sakes, but you know, if you fell off the monkey bars and you broke your arm or what have you, you learn from that. And that was a part of growing up. But now we need all this rubberized matting and stuff. And even though I have a 15-month-old and I take him to the playground and stuff, it's just some of this I'm not sure about.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Here comes our final question. Go right ahead, caller.
Hello. The Council for the State made a reference that in order to participate in the grant program, Trinity had to agree to curriculum requirements in their preschool. I was very surprised by that, and just as a factual matter, trying to understand what curriculum preconditions were imposed in this context.
So there were a variety of different things that you could be given points for in the application. One of them was how much of your playground resurfacing mat includes scrap tires generated in Missouri. So that would actually address their concern of getting tires out of their landfills. Another was whether the playground is used by kids from low-income homes. And the curriculum criteria that you're referring to was part of the application insofar as the school actually had designed a recycling education curriculum to help the kids understand more about recycling and the benefits of recycling. If you had that kind of a curricular program, you would get more points in your application to be able to receive the grant. And so that was the basis of the curriculum aspect of the application.
Thank you.
Very good. We've got a couple minutes left. It looks like we're out of questions. I want to come back to each of our speakers to get a final thought from them. I assume this is going to be maybe a last day of the term sort of decision. You can address that, but give us any final thoughts you might have. Let's go in reverse order. Ilya Shapiro?
I think I've said everything. I caution anyone who's optimistic or pessimistic based on what we've discussed that it ain't over till it's over, and we've had so many twists and turns and surprises, legally speaking, at the Supreme Court and in our political world since this case was first granted. So nothing's over until the opinion's printed and released.
That is certainly true. I think just based on what we heard in oral argument today, I'm very optimistic about how this opinion is going to come out. And I think to get 7 justices on the court to say that not receiving this kind of a grant is a burden on your constitutional right is a huge step forward in our First Amendment jurisprudence in this area. And if we have an opinion that says in the context of public safety benefits, you can't deny these kinds of benefits based on religious status, I think that's going to be an extremely important decision that will have ramifications in many different contexts around the country for religious organizations. So I'm really optimistic and very hopeful based on what we heard in argument today that this is going to be a lopsided opinion in favor of the church and will go a long way towards advancing First Amendment jurisprudence in this area.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. I want to thank you both for joining us today and look forward to the outcome of this case, and maybe we'll have you both back again for a teleforum looking at the opinion. So thank you both on my own behalf and on behalf of the Federal Society. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call Monday at 2 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.